Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of rare and unusual neuroendocrine tumours, also known as NETs. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with NETs discuss individual patient cases to highlight new and emerging approaches to diagnosis and treatment, and the impact of effective multidisciplinary teamwork and coordination on patient care. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Advanced Accelerator Applications and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist, an endocrinologist, and a nuclear medicine specialist discuss the case of a female patient who presents with a lung NET and the factors guiding treatment selection, together with emerging treatment options for patients with lung NETs.
Hello, my name is Diane Reedy Lagunes. I'm a medical oncologist and associate deputy physician in chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and in the United States. I'm joined today by my colleagues and friends, Dr. Thomas Hope, who's a nuclear medicine physician and director of molecular therapy at UCSF in San Francisco, also in the United States, and Professor Dr. Med Marianne Pavel, an endocrinologist and chair of endocrinology at the Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany. In this section, we will be considering the question, mapping an individualized treatment plan, what role does the multidisciplinary team play? Tom and Marianne, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
I'd like to start off with a complicated case of a young woman who's 41, who has a history of chronic cough and intermittent wheezing that was unfortunately misdiagnosed for a very long time, started to get more symptoms, some weight loss, some fatigue, and eventually is diagnosed with a bronchopulmonary NET or a lung NET, but with a pattern which is atypical, although I will say it's not so uncommon for lung neuroendocrine cancers. And as you can see here by the pathology, it was a higher grade tumor, Ki-67 of 30%, and sometimes not all institutions will give Ki-67 for lung NET. This one happened to do that, but synaptophysin and chromogranin were retained. Sometimes we use P53 to see if that is expressed in a wild type to differentiate between poorly differentiated versus well differentiated. And RB was also retained. So they got a PET dotatate. And as you can see here, there was metastatic disease in the lymph nodes, particularly in the chest area, some pleural disease, as well as in the bone. So unfortunate evidence of metastatic disease, despite the multiple symptoms that she had for multiple years that people failed to diagnose. But the uptake of the SUV, as you can see, were not quite that avid. They were single digits. The hottest SUV, if you will, was 8.2. And here are some pictures of some of the disease in the chest. So I'd like to comment first, Tom, what do you think so far about this type of cancer of the lung, this neuroendocrine? And as a nuclear medicine expert, what would be your approach, if you will, when you're seeing this patient for the first time?
Well, I think there's a couple of points you could make here. So first of all, that middle image is clearly showing that you can window to make something look very avid, right? And that makes it look like there's a lot of uptake. But you really have to look at the uptake relative to the liver, right? Which is sort of like the modified Krenning score applied to a dotatate PET. And the liver is usually an SUV mean or max 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there. So the majority of this patient's disease is less avid than the liver, which would make this person not a particularly good candidate for PRT. And in fact, based on our guidelines, is not a candidate for PRT. Though I will add one caveat to that is the NETTER-1 trial, which did not include bronchopulmonary neuroendocrine tumors, used an uptake greater than the liver on an Octrea scan. And an Octrea scan has lower sensitivity for uptake. So this patient would definitely have had a negative Octrea scan relative to the liver. So this patient would have been, based on this imaging study, a fairly poor candidate and would not typically be selected for PRRT.
Yeah, and I think that's incredibly important because it's quote avid, I get a lot of referrals for PRRT because the final report is read by avid, but it's sort of when the numbers are so low, there's just not enough receptors there for the radiation therapy to actually bind to the disease, and more importantly, often that results in proliferative rates that are higher. As we know, this one is 30%. And so these tumors are growing a little bit faster. So cytotoxic therapies, whether it's platinum therapies or temozolomide-based therapies, we would often consider even everolimus. Marion, any comments that you may have in terms of the treatment and a workup for a patient like this?
Yeah, this is an interesting case. As you already mentioned, the Ki-67 is rather high. Some would even classify it at a well-differentiated NACHI3. And the treatments that have been evaluated in lung carcinoids is everolimus. That is the only registered compound. But also there are data that support the use of temozolomide. And sometimes even platinum-based chemotherapy would be required. But I think it is very important to look exactly at the pathology and that we have some information that P53 is intact as well as RB1. So that is not a large or small cell neck. And one would think in this scenarios with a lack of expression of somatostatin receptors and a rather high Ki-67, this could be a good candidate for platinum-based chemotherapy, like in lung cancer. We would need to really reconsider that because it is frequently too toxic, because patients may respond to less toxic treatments like temozolomide or even everolimus. That would be my preferred choice. For the higher Ki-67, my preferred choice would be a temozolomide-based regimen because we also have data to support temozolomide use in NACHI3. And this does not exclude that at the later stage, platinum-based chemotherapy may be considered, but definitely that is not a priori candidate for platinum-based chemotherapy like cisplatinum or etoposide. That is a common treatment for large cell or small cell neck.
Yeah, again, I think that's so critically important because, you know, very often someone might say, well, this is, maybe we'll start with a somatostatin analog. But again, with this higher grade tumors, particularly in the lung nets, they can have a more aggressive pattern. And so the pathology really, like you said, Marianne, is critical for us to help us guide management. Anything else in terms of endocrine workup that you would find helpful for a case like this, for example, or quite frankly, for any lung net in particular?
Thank you for that question. Definitely. I always spend a lot of time with the patient to inspect the patient and to ask for all kinds of complaints. And what we could expect is in 5 to 25%, it's depending on the series reported, a carcinoid syndrome. This means serotonin secretion and secretion of other bioactive compounds that lead to either flushing and or diarrhea. And also wheezing may be present, and there may be also Cushing's syndrome accounting for 5% of the cases. So that's rare. It again needs a high degree of suspicion. Does the patient have any complaints, GI disorders, or does the patient have features that are suspicious of Cushing's syndrome, like a moon phase, facial reddening, abdominal adiposity, fragile skin, hematoma, high blood pressure, hyperglycemia, all these are clinical signs of Cushing syndrome. And I also had some patients that interestingly had been non-functioning and over time they transitioned to a functioning tumor. So a patient that was without Cushing's disease developed Cushing's disease after 5 years. So we always need to be aware of the fact that a functional activity may occur later on.
I completely agree, and the carcinoid syndrome as well. So I just want to reiterate what you said. Like, the idea is you have to do a very careful deep dive into the history and really make sure that your patients don't have any symptoms. We don't want to cast this huge net and do a battery of tests just because, but we really want to drive what we're doing and making sure that if they have any symptoms, we don't miss them and we're working it up. And those questions need to continue over time, because I absolutely have had patients that have developed symptoms related to cortisol and or the carcinoid syndrome over time, depending on, you know, what clones and with progression of disease. Tom, I think part of the reason why lung nets, I would say, are one, they're uncommon, but two, there's a lot of different cooks in the kitchen, if you will. Sometimes it's thoracic oncologists, sometimes it's GI oncologists. So the landscape is a little bit more challenging in terms of evidence-based data to help drive the care for these patients. Can you share a little bit about what clinical trials we have on the horizon and what we might learn in the near future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's interesting, for example, at our institution, how GI oncology manages patients with metastatic bronchial neuroendocrine tumors, right? It's a lung cancer that originally gets diagnosed by a thoracic oncologist. And when that transition occurs is not always consistent. And so there's definitely a very complicated handoff that goes on in the course of these patients' disease. You know, the one trial I'll highlight is obviously the one I'm involved in, which is Alliance trial that's studying lutetium dotatate versus everolimus. This is a phase two study of 108 patients, one-to-one randomization of the two drugs to see if there's improvement with lutetium dotatate versus everolimus. And I think, you know, this case here is a really good case because, you know, the thing that's unique about PRRT is that you do have this biomarker, right? And it's really, we don't have the data actually to show this a predicted biomarker, but hopefully soon we'll have good data to show that somatostatin receptor PET is a predictive biomarker of response. And so the higher your uptake, the higher the response. So if you think it's going to be an interesting trial in that the people with the higher uptake on the baseline somatostatin receptor PET are going to do better than the ones who have lower uptake, with both in terms of overall response, but also relative to everolimus. So I think it'll be an interesting trial. And, you know, I think the struggle with bronchial neuroendocrine tumors is not that common of a disease, right? And so enrolling in these trials is actually really quite difficult to create the literature and the data to support our clinical decisions. And I think that's one of the biggest issues in this area overall with neuroendocrine tumors, but even subsets of neuroendocrine tumors, uncommon of the uncommons, to actually run these trials to create data sets to tell us what we should be doing in terms of treating these patients.
Absolutely. Drs. Hope and Favelle, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchrespiratory.com. Don't forget, there are three other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.